Testing 21, 22, 23. This is a recording for the Purdue University Archives made on the morning of September 22nd in room 268 of the Chemistry Building, Purdue University. This is an interview between Professor Herbert Brown, R.B. Wetherill, Distinguished Professor of Chemistry at Purdue University, and R.B. Eccles of the Department of History. Well, Professor Brown, let us start out by asking the usual questions. Where were you born? Where were you educated? And take us up to the time that you came to Purdue.
I was born in London, England, but came with my parents to America in 1914, at a time when I was 2 years old. I was raised in Chicago and educated in Chicago schools.
What high school?
I went to Englewood High School on the south side of Chicago, and then went to the city colleges of the city of Chicago to receive an Associate of Arts degree in 1935, and then went to the University of Chicago on a scholarship and received there the Bachelor's of Science degree in 1936 and the PhD in 1938.
Who did you work with in your graduate work that had most influence on you?
At the city colleges, I came in contact with a very unusual man, Professor Nicholas Chironis, who had a considerable influence on me. My education was interrupted considerably by the Depression, and I began work at the Crane Junior College in 1933. However, that school was closed after I had attended for one semester, and there was no city college at that time which I could attend. Professor Chironis had a small laboratory on the north side of Chicago known as the Synthetic Laboratories, and there he allowed a number of students to come in and occupy themselves working on chemistry without any cost or charge or so on, without any payments. It was simply a humanitarian gesture on his part. It was there that I met my wife, my present wife, and at that place I did considerable work on my own, for which I later received credit at the University of Chicago, after I had established that I was competent in the areas. And that is why I was able to receive my bachelor's degree at the University of Chicago in 1 year.
That's amazing. I never heard of that being done, although I knew at that time Chicago did honor merit rather than years of servitude.
I should explain, of course, that 1 year was was for my junior and senior years, because I did go to a Wright Junior College for a full year.
And then you entered graduate school. Who did you work with in graduate school?
In graduate school, I worked with Professor H.I. Schlesinger on some relatively rare exotic compounds at that time, known as the hydrides of boron. These were exceedingly unstable materials which could be handled only in the absence of air and water. They were considered to be great rarities. They were made only in milligram quantities, and they were of interest chiefly because they seemed to provide a puzzle for the current theory of chemical bonding. However, largely as a result of our work at that time, we made these things, we developed new methods of synthesis and made these things readily available, And in actual fact, much of my work since that time has been to apply these to specific applications in chemistry.
And what has been the result in commercial products and in research?
In 1939, we received a request from the government in Washington to investigate new volatile compounds of uranium. We were not advised what these were to be used for. We were told that it was important for national defense to find other materials than the currently available uranium hexafluoride, which might be used for certain applications. We undertook to study this problem and discovered a new compound, uranium borohydride, which possessed volatility of the order of magnitude that desired. We were then advised to organize a large research group and undertake to prepare this material in quantity for testing. As a result of this work, we discovered a new compound, sodium borohydride, and new methods for making the boron hydrides in quantity. And these developments resulted in making these materials readily available. Sodium borohydride was never used for the purpose for which we investigated it. However, it has turned out to be an excellent hydrogenating agent in organic chemistry and is widely used in the pharmaceutical field for the manufacture of drugs and pharmaceuticals, as well as many other applications.
Did some of this research in 39 and obviously in 42 point towards the Argonne Laboratories and the development of the nuclear fission?
Yes. The real reason for doing this work originally was that the government was working on the separation of uranium isotopes. To do this, they needed volatile compounds of uranium. Uranium hexafluoride was well known as a volatile intermediate, but it was a highly corrosive material, and there was some question originally whether the problems of handling uranium hexafluoride could be solved. So a backup material was desired. The compound we discovered, uranium borohydride, was such a backup material. But since the problems for handling uranium hexafluoride were solved, there was no need for our backup material. However, I think it is an interesting point that research done to develop a material for use in the separation of uranium isotopes should have found this major application in the pharmaceutical industry for the manufacture of drugs to help human suffering.
But you say this is one of the dangers of cutting off research, because here you have something extremely useful for humanity coming out that you didn't anticipate and others did, but you've got to have something come out, something researched and found, and then having a different application applied. In other words, this is a feedback of pure research, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Is it important to continue such things?
It certainly is. One of the dangers of the present pressures to do research directed only towards specific goals is that we cannot foresee all the things, all the consequences of certain research, and we certainly need a certain part of our research effort developed purely for exploring the physical world. If we do such research and exercise our imaginations, we will be able to apply these to solve many of the problems that face us. If we restrict ourselves solely to solve the problems that face us using the tools presently available, we will probably be overlooking many other more useful tools.
I should think there'd be no question of that. Well, let's get back to you and your career. What did you do during the war years?
During 1939 to 1943, I was at the University of Chicago as assistant to Professor Schlesinger, and I worked on this project first for the Manhattan District to develop uranium borohydride. Then we received a project from the Signal Corps because they were interested in developing a convenient method for the field generation of hydrogen. And sodium borohydride appeared to be a promising material for that application. In 1943, I went to Wayne University in Detroit as assistant professor of chemistry. Wayne at that time had just begun a graduate program. When I arrived there, there were only two master's candidates and no laboratory or equipment. And I had to initiate research work with my own efforts. However, things developed there rather rapidly. A PhD program was instituted in 1945. And with the end of the war, there was a considerable influx of graduate students. And I was making rapid progress there when I was invited to come down to Purdue by Henry Haas, chairman of the department, in 1947. I found it difficult to decide whether to leave Wayne. It was a place that I had arrived at where there had been nothing, and we had managed to build a considerable research program. However, the university in Detroit was situated in the center part of the city. My wife and child were out near the edges of the city. And my wife at the University of Chicago had been accustomed to being an intimate part of a university community. This was not possible in Detroit. When I came to Lafayette and saw what a lovely little city this was without the problems of the large city, I decided that for my family's sake, it would be better to move to Lafayette.
Didn't the opportunities for research in an established chemistry department with people like McBee and Haas and the old guard that were here at the time, Brian Bachman and that group, didn't they have a sufficiently national reputation or international reputation to make coming here rather an attractive thing to work with these men?
I'm afraid that this was not a significant factor in my thinking.
What I'm after, of course, is the obvious thing. Was this a good department?
This was a good department, but in actual fact, the main consideration in my mind were two things. One, there was a large going department here, which meant that I would not have to do the enormous spade work necessary to institute new procedures. But even more important was the fact that this was, to my mind, a lovely place in which to live.
You would be amazed at the number of people who have indicated in their interviews that they came to Lafayette for that reason. It was a good place to bring up your children, and it was a nice country town, and they sort of liked it. Well, from that, let
me say in that regard that since then I've had a number of invitations to go elsewhere and have turned all down. Many people have indicated that they consider Lafayette to be a relatively quiet, perhaps I should say dead place, without a great many distractions. But I found that to be very pleasant. I think it's an ideal environment for students. There's so little to distract them from their studies. They're the time of graduate work should be a time when a man tests himself, his abilities to produce new original things, and he has his best opportunity to demonstrate this in a place like Lafayette, where he can concentrate without being continually distracted by either physical things such as boating on the ocean or swimming or hiking, as well as the agitation that goes on in other places. So I personally believe that Lafayette can offer students the ideal environment to develop themselves.
From the point of view of physical facilities, with the addition of the new chemistry building, we will have pretty adequate facilities for research in your area?
Yes, the university has always been quite good to me, and I feel that I have had adequate facilities ever since I arrived here in 1947.
Well, let's go put on tape. What did your research and your scholarly production, what direction did it take from 47 up to the present?
I have worked in several areas. I came to Purdue as professor of inorganic chemistry, but my interests have always been broad, and my work actually cut across many areas. I have accepted students and carried on research in inorganic chemistry, organic chemistry, and physical chemistry. My work has tended to be both theoretical in certain areas and practical in other areas. I should say that my work has largely centered on the theme of the role of boron in chemistry, and I've applied boron and boron compounds to the study of both theoretical problems and the solution of practical problems.
When you say practical problems, can you detail that a little for us?
By practical problems, I mean I have explored the chemistry of boron and developed new methods for synthesizing organic compounds as well as inorganic compounds through the application of boron chemistry.
What have they been used for?
These boron compounds have been used for reductions in organic chemistry. They have been used to make organoborines, which have unusual properties and can be used for synthesis. There is an entire chemistry of architecture, of building up complex molecules from simple molecules, which the boron compounds are extraordinarily useful as the tools which to construct such complex structures.
Does this have anything to do, for example, with using boron in detergents?
No. That is simply boric acid or a salt of boron, which is found in nature and is simply put into the detergent as a sequestering agent and to control the pH. Our work is largely to make organic compounds containing boron. These are substances which are highly reactive. They do not exist in nature as far as we know, but they were essentially unknown at the time we started our work. And now we have described a huge chemistry of these materials and people interested in structural development now we'll have to learn all this chemistry in order to use these compounds to construct the desired structures they need in their work.
What specifically in the way of things that the ordinary citizen would see, is it used in developing, let us say, some machinery or in building and strength of metals and materials?
No, it is used for making large complex organic substances, Such substances, for example, would be steroids, which are used in birth control pills. They are used for rheumatism and similar difficulties, sex hormones. There are many applications of these kinds of materials. At one time, the material was used for the manufacture of synthetic vitamin A. In other words, most of the materials that the body utilizes are complex organic substances. Most of the drugs that are used are complex organic substances. And these require that they be built up from simpler molecules. And the boron intermediates provide one of the routes whereby these more complex structures can be built up from simpler building stones.
Well, you made so at Purdue. Have you made Purdue Chemistry Department, you and your colleagues, sort of the center for this research in the United States?
Yes, I should say that this work, the discovery of this reaction, was made at Purdue. The exploration of organoborane chemistry has largely been done at Purdue. So I would say that Purdue is the center not merely of the United States, but of the world for research in this area.
You've had students come from abroad to work with you, haven't you, in this area?
Yes, I have had many students from all over the world. Indeed, I have just returned from a 8-week lecture trip in Japan, and while there, I met one of my former associates in practically every part of Japan. I have had 16 postdoctorates from Japan come here to work with me. There are now 6 full professors among this group back in Japan.
And at various universities.
At various universities.
What nation in Europe has sent its people to you mostly? I knew one of your graduate students from Britain. I forget his name at the moment. He married a very charming German girl and was teaching at Göttingen for a while, but he was here about...
Brian Garner.
Brian, that's a gentleman. Yeah. He was here about 6 years ago.
Yes. He is now teaching at Leeds.
At Leeds.
University of Leeds. But I would say that the largest contingent that I have had have been Japanese students. The first was a Professor Boratani who came here in 1951. He's now a professor at Osaka University. And since that time, I've had many from Japan. I've also had a considerable number from India, England, Germany, Switzerland, Korea, and other places.
Well, to follow the pattern of other lectures, let's do this. What is, as you see it, what is the future of research in this area from the Purdue point of view? Where are we going?
From this area, I can't say. I am within 8 years of retirement. I have uncovered an enormous gold mine, and I'm busy mining the gold as fast as I can. Whether the work will continue at Purdue after I'm gone will depend upon whether the department adds any member to its staff who is interested in the area.
This is very true. And it depends on who is the head of the department at the time, won't it?
No. No. The head, as we operate in the chemistry department, the head has nothing to do with the fields that the individual members decide they wish to work in. They are completely independent. The only choice that he might make is that he might attempt to persuade the organic division to add a man capable of continuing the work in this area.
And thus you'd have a reputation at Purdue as a great place and continue it.
That's right.
Are you getting adequate does Purdue give adequate financial support for your research? Or do you get it from outside?
Purdue does not contribute significantly to the support of my research program. Essentially, all the money that I receive, that I use in this research, comes from grants from outside agencies.
Would this be private companies, or would it be national scientific organizations?
Chiefly from government agencies. For example, I have one grant from the National Science Foundation. I have a second grant from the National Institutes of Health. I have a third grant from the Army Research Office at Durham. I have another grant from the Humble Oil Company, Esso Research and Engineering Company, all of which I use to support the research in this area. In addition to this, I attract a number of very capable students who manage to get grants of their own. Thus, I have one man who was here as a postdoctorate, supported by the National Institutes of Health. I have two students who have National Science Foundation fellowships, which they won through their own efforts. There are additional students who are here on various fellowships, so that about nearly half of my group are supported by funds that these students acquired on their own through their own abilities and through winning awards in national competitions.
You know, I'll wager that the average person thinking of chemistry thinks that the university provides the funds, and yet this is normal, isn't it? The average university can't support the research of any one man doing the sort of thing you're doing. It has to come from grants.
That is right. In chemistry in the 30s in this country was very primitive, and there were no sources of funds. What research was done in a man's spare time, using little pieces of equipment that were around the department and were actually usually purchased for other needs. And we were a backwater of world chemistry. Since the 30s, we have come forth to where we are the world's leaders in chemistry. And in large part, this is made possible by the funds which the national government provides. The universities themselves provide merely the laboratories for the work, but in general, they provide very little of the money that is used in research.
How do you account for the sudden shift of interest? Is it due to the war?
I don't understand.
Well, you said in the 30s, we were, as a nation, backward in chemistry. Now, you say we're not. We're the leaders. What was responsible for the change?
Well, this is a complex thing, but I would say one of the factors was the Depression. I believe the Depression caused a large number of very smart boys to elect to go into scientific careers rather than go into advertising or becoming bond salesmen. So first, there was a group of highly intelligent young men who went into science and converted what was then a scientifically developing country into one of the leaders. In addition to this, the government during the war provided support for science and made it possible for the first time for people to undertake systematic research programs. All of these were directed towards specific needs connected with the war. The policy set in motion at that time carried on after the war. Various agencies continued to support research until the present time.
In other words, science came into its own from 1940 up to 1970.
That is correct.
Well, let's get to another thing that began following up a pattern. When you look around at chemistry departments in the Big Ten, and I know that this is a this is a loaded question. What are the best departments in the Big Ten, and what do you think is the best department in the Big Ten chemistry?
That's a question that I prefer not to answer.
All right.
I have many friends, and by answering such questions, you soon lose friends.
You can do it, but how do you rate us on a national scale then? Obviously, Purdue does have a splendid chemistry department. Mr. McBee has told me what he thought his answer is.
I believe that as a department, we will certainly rank in the top 10% of the departments of chemistry in the country. That is in quality. In quantity, I would say, in size, we actually rank among the top 5 departments in the country. That would be in the top 2%.
Yes. On a regional basis, and this is just personal opinion if you want to venture it, where would you find the best chemistry, say, in the East, in the Ivy League?
Well, there's no doubt that Harvard has, for many years, maintained one of the leading departments of chemistry in the country.
I don't understand it. Why? I don't mean that as a simple question, but I mean Harvard seems to have so many leading departments. Is it because of the money or the prestige or the opportunities, the scientific and intellectual climate?
I haven't attempted to analyze why, but I believe that the prestige of Harvard causes that school to attract many of the best students. And because they have many of the best students, they have real difficulty in persuading professors to come there.
I understand. In other good schools in the East, how about Yale, Cornell?
Yale, Cornell, Princeton have also had first-rate departments of chemistry.
We move to the West Coast. Berkeley in California would be the outstanding one?
Yes, Berkeley has certainly been the outstanding. I believe most people in many areas would have ranked Berkeley next to Harvard. I should say that in my own area, organic chemistry, I do not consider it to be in the same caliber, but certainly in physical and inorganic chemistry, they have been among the leaders for many, many years.
Do we have any outstanding schools in the Northwest? University of Washington?
No, that's relatively new. It's growing and it's developing, but I would say that graduate university training is relatively new in the Northwest.
What about the South?
There have not been any departments that I would consider to be among the leaders in the South.
Are there some growing?
Texas, I would say, is perhaps one of the few that seems to be developing.
I'm interested in that. I'll be going down to Texas on another matter in connection with the foundation. Texas seems to have money for equipment, but no money for salaries.
Well, apparently, I'm not certain I understand, but I've heard that they have oil lands in which the revenue can be used for the capital needs for the university, but not for operation funds.
I saw books upon books and book crates that had not been uncrated of original editions of in the history of science of Dutch and French and English scientists, 17th century, 18th century, had not even been uncrated yet. Didn't have storage space, didn't have anything else. It's fascinating. All right. When we get to that, then we come down to...
Our problem is the exact opposite. Normally, we seem to get money for salaries, but it's next to impossible to get capital funds for buildings.
Well, it's taken a long time, hasn't it, to get this building started? I knew Professor Mellon reasonably well at one time. He helped the department supervise this new structure, didn't he? Did you have a hand in planning it too? I presume every professor did.
Not a great deal. Generally, these things, it's best to leave it to the committee. That's too many soups spoil the broth.
Sure.
But you remember this building itself was originally this department had a relatively small building, about one-third of the present building,
inside,
which was supposed to have been, which was built in 1928 or so. The rest of it was supposed to have been completed in 1940. The war came and construction was frozen. After the war, efforts began again, and we actually had to spread this out over something like 5 years.
True.
In order to get a little bit at a time.
I remember it was rough going.
Yes.
Where have you lectured or taught? On leaves of absence and so on, besides Purdue.
I have been visiting professor at a number of universities. I can mention UCLA, University of California, Los Angeles, Ohio State University, University of California at Berkeley, Colorado University, University of Colorado at Boulder. Last fall, I was at Cornell University. I have spent a month as visiting professor at the University of California at Santa Barbara, another period at the State University of New York at Stony Brook. I've been at Hebrew University abroad.
And in Jerusalem?
In Jerusalem. And Heidelberg University in Germany. And I've just come from a 2 month lecture trip through Japan.
When you lecture at Heidelberg, do you lecture in German or in English?
No, I'm not a good linguist, so I always lecture in English. And I've learned to speak slowly and to use slides which tell their own story so that people who have trouble following the English that I speak can read the story as the talk progresses.
All right, now, is there something you'd like to put on the record? Because as I say, this will be used for the archives. Is there anything that you would like to talk about in our interview? We've covered very quickly most of the major topics. One thing that if you would like to talk about scientists and men of intellectual caliber in science, is there anything you'd like to say about them whom you've met and who helped you or whom you have influenced or been influenced by or even opposed to?
Really, I don't know of anything I'd care to say.
You've never worked cooperatively with any men who have been, for example, Nobel Prize winners and so on?
No, I've always felt that science is a wonderful career in that one has the opportunity today to do creative work in which one works for the benefit of humanity. The more knowledge we have, the more things we should be able to do. And so I have always felt that we live at a wonderful time when we can do work that is fascinating and still contributes to human development. I have never except during the war, I've never worked on a program which has been narrowly defined to accomplish a particular objective. I feel that I am one of the explorers of the human race to search out new areas of knowledge and new techniques, new methods, and to make these part of the heritage of our society, so that I have never attempted to work on a cooperative program of others to solve specific problems.
You sound very much the way Carl Lockhartz used to sound when talking about physics. Did you know Mr. Lockhartz?
I knew him, but not well. He was on campus at the time I was on campus, but again, one is usually so busy with your own activities, you don't have much time to get over into other departments to become acquainted.
I hope that I put this on a record that you will put down the list of your major publications and list, of course, the national and international honors that you've received. This will, of course, come in the typed appendix. Is there anything, however, in your research, any piece of research that's been published that you'd particularly like to talk about now? Anything you're fond of?
No, I think I'm fond of all my research.
Well, naturally, but sometimes there's the first article or the first essay in the field that you sort of look back on with fondness and why you did it.
Well, the discovery of the hydroboration reaction came about through an accidental observation. We were studying the reduction of various organic compounds by sodium borohydride. It proved to be a very mild reducing agent, and we were attempting to make it a more powerful one, that so that it would reduce more compounds. And we discovered that the addition of aluminum chloride to sodium borohydride converted the original mild reducing agent to a much more active species. And we were exploring the reduction of all the representative classes of organic compounds by this new reducing agent. Dr. B.C. Subbarao, a postdoctorate from India, was working with me on the problem. And he reported that this material reduced nitriles to amines, esters to alcohols, amides to amines, etc. One of the compounds that he ran was an unsaturated fatty ester, ethyl oleate. It should have taken up 2 moles of hydride per mole of compound for reduction to the alcohol. Yet his result indicated that it had taken up 2.37 moles. I asked him what was the reason for the high value, and he offered the suggestion that the compound he had used might not have been pure, that there was present an impurity which used the additional 37 hundredths of a mole. He wanted to forget about this little discrepancy, but a research director is in an excellent position to insist upon high standards, since he doesn't have to do the work himself.
That is an advantage, isn't it?
Yes. So I recommended that he go back to the laboratory and repeat the experiment with purified materials. He did, and obtained the same number, 2.37. Clearly, it was not the purity of the ethyl oleate that was responsible for the high value. We investigated and found that with a longer reaction time, the value went up to 3 and then became constant. we concluded that the carbon-to-carbon double bond in the molecule was reacting with the reagent. We discovered it was producing an organoborane, and that was how we discovered the hydroboration reaction, which now provides us with a new route to organoborenes. Of course, once we discovered this new simple route to organoborenes, we began to explore the chemistry of these materials. And this has uncovered a major new universe for organic chemistry.
Thank you for describing for posterity how it was done. I am chairman of a committee of the Society of American Archivists to preserve scientific and technological data. And this is the sort of thing that every scientist ought to do. Thank you for doing it. Is there anything else that you've done that you'd like to in this way? This is for the record, you know.
Well, I would say that I believe being a university professor is perhaps the ideal career. One works with young people at the nicest time of their lives, when their futures are ahead of them. They're all striving to train themselves to find their abilities and hopefully to work towards a promising future. One then works with these young people and does his best to teach them the methods, the tools, the techniques of thinking to accomplish worthwhile research. At the same time then, one not only trains young people, but one is in a position to do creative work and to publish them and leave it behind him as a memorial to his efforts. So I believe it is an ideal existence. I should say that the hours are long and the work is heavy, but it's in the case one really is working for oneself and it's work that one thoroughly enjoys. Many people often ask me, what are my hobbies? Well, I say my hobby is chemistry. My work is chemistry, I enjoy both, and I see no need to go and try to find some other activity to refresh my interest in my work, or to relieve the frustrations that build up in my work. This does not occur in a career such as I've had in chemistry.
Of course, that's a secret, isn't it, of science?
Yes.
What you do in science is, as you say, both your hobby. Of course, you may say, well, Bogart, you may play golf, but that's incidental. It's really not what you're doing. You're really trying to do some thinking and leave it and make a mark. What kind of a world, though, have you created and the scientists have created? Do you hold anything, and I'll just, the common theory, because I like your reaction to it. You know this crazy thing that we've made a world of science and technology, but the mores and understanding of society of science and technology is back in the 18th century, whereas we are in the 21st century.
Well, this is an argument I don't understand. There are more people living today who have access to the good things of life, who can read, who can enjoy literature, who can avoid pestilence and famine and so on than ever before in human existence. I do not understand the pessimism people have. We have problems, but they are minor problems compared to those of the past, and they will easily be solved by applying our intelligence and our efforts towards their solution.
Yes, but, all right, now just for the sake of getting their reaction, well, everything you say is true, and yet science has made it possible to exterminate life on this globe within not a matter of days, but a matter of minutes. What do you say to that one?
Well, all I can say is that there have been fewer people killed in the past 25 years through war than probably in any other 25-year period of human existence in the last 2,000 years.
You'd attribute that to science or fear of science?
I don't know the reason, but the fact is there that...
Of course, there's been no major international war.
Yet, but that's the first time in a huge... in a long period of time. Now, it's true that we have this horrible capacity to exterminate life, but in actual fact, nature had this at her command many times. Let's recall that when the Huns came down through Asia, the Mongols came down through Asia, I believe the figures were that they killed off two-thirds of the people and the countries they overran. The Black Death in Europe 50%. Killed off 50% or more of the humans living then in Europe. No war that we have had has done this, and hopefully none will occur. But these are problems that I think can be solved by human intelligence. The previous problems we couldn't solve through human intelligence.
For sure. The answer is the use of energy such as the atomic bomb. And what I think you're arguing is that the very fact that science has created this should be, for intelligent, logical people, a deterrent.
Yes, let's remember there's no change whether the first man that discovered fire did tremendous good for human beings. At the same time, he created a weapon that human beings might use to destroy each other. And it's up to human beings to decide how to use their knowledge. And hopefully, as we get things more and more under our control, we will use these things for the good of the human race rather than for its destruction.
This is, of course, the hope of the scientist. However, people who are not scientists continue to make destructive use of what obviously ought to be the use of science for promotion of for humanity. The more people that are born into the world now, you've destroyed the ecology in the sense that people live longer, eat up more food, create more waste. Do you think science can deal with these problems?
Well, science is dealing with these problems and does provide the solutions. It's up then to the people to be educated to these solutions and to be persuaded to adopt them.
This is
not the role of the scientists then. This becomes the role of the politicians and other leaders to persuade the people to adopt these solutions. The point is that science provides the solutions. Without science, we wouldn't have the solutions to these problems.
Then you differ somewhat from people like Urey, who would say that the scientist is responsible for his actions, and that when a man creates something like a tremendous destructive capacity of the atomic bomb, he's responsible if the atomic bomb is used to destroy.
I disagree with that. I believe that all of us are obligated, whether it's scientists or not, are obligated to use all the knowledge we have for the benefit of the human race.
In other words, the scientist is part of it.
That's right.
Strikes me, however, that the importance that our society must learn the limits of the scientific instrumentation and changes that people like you have created. We've got to keep up with, I won't say with you and research, naturally not, but society has got to learn to use what science has accomplished and to take advantage correctly of the opportunities that science has given. In other words, you've got to learn how to use these tools.
I believe that we are learning this. I believe this is no problem in the developed countries, the educated countries, where the population is educated to the role of science, and we these problems can be solved.
And what about putting this into the hands of the little irresponsible, though? I shiver every time I think of, let us say, an Egyptian or even a Hindu or an Indian getting a hold of an atomic weapon. Look at the Chinese, for example.
Well, hopefully the time will come when all these things will be under international control and human beings will learn to live together and solve their problems by peaceful means rather than through conflict.
They haven't yet, but maybe they will. And of course, I hate to say this, but maybe science will create a fear element that will give them pause to think.
The point, though, is, as I've mentioned, that in spite of all the agitation about what has happened since the end of World War II, about all the conflicts, the fact is there hasn't been a really major conflict on this globe in the past 25 years. And recall that in World War II, 40 million people died. In World War I, which occurred just 20 years prior to that, another 30 or so million people died.
20 million alone in Russia. Well, I'm delighted to hear the scientist being optimistic about what about his field and about the condition of humanity. It's wonderful to hear this. Is there anything else you'd like to put on tape to talk about?
I don't think so.
Very good. The transcript will be sent to you, and with your permission, sir, we will say that this is the end of an interview between Professor Herbert Brown and Professor Eccles of the Department of History. It is for the Purdue University Archives and will be placed there ultimately.
Okay? Thank you.